Canada. And something we had to know about that this is that Trudeau is on record multiple times condemning the BDS movement. That's the movement to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel until it stops its human rights abuses against Palestinians. He's called it anti-Semitic in the past and cracked down on it in college on college campuses in Canada. This is despite the fact that about almost 80% of Canadians don't think that it is anti-Semitic to engage in a peaceful boycott of Israel. And of course, you know, this, there's no indication that it's anti-Semitic whatsoever. But what this does indicate is that there's a sort of a worldwide push amongst the West and its allies to try and censor free speech when it comes to criticism of Israel. We've seen, of course, Mike Pompeo, when he was in the West Bank recently, he declared BDS as a cancer and said that it was anti-Semitic. And we know in the United States there's been legislation passed in over 25 states there, unconstitutional, by the way, so that people cannot have that free speech right of engaging in a peaceful boycott.
What have folks been saying about this story online?
The first one we've got here is from U.S. journalist Max Blumenthal, who says, Justin Trudeau taps Erwin Kotler, the Canadian version of Alan Dershowitz, as de facto anti-Palestinian czar. Kotler will lead the center-left government's assault on free speech and policing of Palestine solidarity organizing. Got another one here as well, who's likening Trudeau to Obama and says, Trudeau is the Obama of Canada. It talks nice, but it's evil to the core.
All right. Robert and Lakesh, with those stories and the tweets that followed them. Robert, thank you as always. And thank you. Until we meet again, goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
The UK government has created a potentially unlawful blacklist of the names of people seeking information under the country's Freedom of Information Act, two investigative journalists have discovered. The names of charity workers, campaigners, and journalists have been entered on the list without their knowledge, in an apparent breach of the UK's privacy laws. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, which is published under the heading UK Government Blacklisted Journalists Over Freedom of Information Requests. Here's the details of this article. The UK government has created a potentially unlawful blacklist of the names of people seeking information under the country's Freedom of Information Act, two investigative journalists have discovered. The names of charity workers, campaigners, and journalists have been entered on the list without their knowledge in an apparent breach of the UK's privacy laws. Journalists working for Associated Press, Guardian, and other news organizations are known to have been placed on the list along with people working for Friends of the Earth, Privacy International, and other NGOs. It is thought that none of them have been informed. The discovery of the blacklist comes at a time when the British government is mounting efforts to stem the release of information under the Act. We'll be right back. A recent survey conducted by the UK National Union of Journalists found that its members now believe the government's increasing disregard of transparency laws is a greater impediment to their work than the UK's notoriously stringent libel laws. British government departments are granting fewer and refusing more Freedom of Information Act requests than at any time in the law's 15-year history. The blacklist was discovered by Jenna Corderi and Peter Joincom, two journalists with the Open Democracy website. It is maintained within a unit known as Clearing House, located within the Cabinet Office, the department that supports the Prime Ministers and coordinates the work of government. The Cabinet Office initially refused to disclose the list, but the Information Commissioner's Office, which oversees the implementation of the Act, ordered it to do so. It includes applicants' names, which were redacted before the list was handed over, along with the names of their employers and details of their work. It is still refusing to disclose documentation relating to the list, including advice that it offers to other British government departments. It is planning to appeal to the courts against the Information Commissioner's ruling that more details of the Clearing House operations should be made public. Requests for information under the Freedom of Information Act are supposed to be applicant-blind, with government departments not discriminating for or against individuals who make them. The court that hears the Cabinet Office appeal may also rule on the legality of the Clearing House operations, with some privacy law experts believing it may be declared unlawful. John Baines, a data protection advisor at London law firm Mishkan Doreya, said, "I am far from assured that the operation of the Clearing House complies with data protection law. It appears to use a round-robin list by which FOI requesters' names are circulated around all government departments. Requesters would not normally have a reasonable expectation that their details would be so widely disclosed, and in most cases, it does not appear that they are informed that this will happen. Moreover, I suspect that most requesters would object to the breadth of this disclosure. Data protection law requires, as a basic principle, that personal data be processed fairly and in a transparent manner. On the evidence that I have seen, I do not feel that the Clearing House meets these requirements," he added. Gavin Frigard, head of data and transparency at the Institute for Government, said that 15 years after the Freedom of Information Act came into effect, the public was still having to fight to access information, with delayed responses, more requests being rejected than ever before, and these reports of a clearinghouse, it feels like we are having to fight for the right to information all over again. And all this at a time when it's vital for politicians, the press and the public to be able to scrutinize government. A number of British politicians also expressed alarm at the discovery of the Clearing House. David Davis, a Conservative former cabinet minister, said, "The whole purpose of the Freedom of Information Act was to increase transparency and accountability of government. To that explicit end, all requests are legally required to be treated independent of who the applicant is. This Clearing House is certainly against the spirit of that act, and probably the letter too. Ministers should explain to the House of Commons precisely why they continue with this setup, in view of the fact that it is contradictory to the whole purpose of freedom of information." Helen Hayes, Shadow Cabinet Office Minister with the opposition Labour Party, said, "This is extremely troubling. If the Cabinet Office is interfering in FOI requests and seeking to work around the requirements of the Act by blacklisting journalists, it is a grave threat to our values and transparency in our democracy. The government minister heading the Cabinet Office, Michael Gove, has a history of attempting to undermine the effectiveness of the UK's Freedom of Information Act. In 2010, while Education Secretary, he was discovered to be sending emails through an account in the name of his wife. His advisors called this Mrs. Blair account. Gove's officials at the Education Department systematically destroyed correspondence, and his closest political advisor, Dominic Cummings, told colleagues that he would answer only those emails that came from personal accounts. The Information Commissioner concluded that the department should be subject to special monitoring to ensure that it complied with the law.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia are the main culprits on the issue of Takfiri groups.
On the issue of Takfiri orientations, the main crime was committed by the Americans as well as by the Saudis who followed them. The Saudis paid them money and they helped and supported them. The Americans committed another crime as well. They sent their army to Muslim countries with the excuse of the presence of such terrorist groups. They sent their forces to Afghanistan, to Syria, and to other countries. As for other countries such as Iraq, they have been thinking about sending their forces, but the Iraqi youth and the Iraqi believers will not allow them to do so. Their legitimate zeal and enthusiasm will prevent the Americans from exerting their influence, God willing. But they have this plan anyway, and thereafter infiltrating these countries. Of course, wherever they set foot in, they caused insecurity and destruction. They have really destroyed the infrastructures of these countries. They have caused insecurity. They have waged domestic wars, and they have done something to occupy the minds of governments with these thoughts so that they will not be able to carry out their main duties. They have really destroyed crops and cattle. His aim everywhere is to destroy crops and cattle. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 205. The ayah is about these people in the true sense of the word, and they have really done these things.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Sayyidul Aqwam.
my opinion, Unity Week is very important, and unity is a cure for many maladies of the Islamic Ummah. In the present time, the disastrous war in Yemen, during which that oppressed nation has been subject to bombardments on the streets, in the markets, in their houses, at school, and in public ceremonies for 5 years, this is not a minor incident. Rather, it is a very grave one. The Saudis are really acting in a very cruel manner on this matter.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In an attempt to pressure China, the U.S. President Donald Trump initiated a trade war in 2018 and ratcheted up tariffs on Chinese imports to the American market. By early 2020, these amounted to over $400 billion in tariffs, with China imposing its own retaliatory tariffs of $138 billion on its U.S. imports. Such steps have taken place amid ongoing trade talks between the two sides and have been viewed as a negotiating tactic that has ultimately been detrimental to both countries' economies. In late 2020, the World Trade Organization WTO said the U.S. tariffs violated international trade rules, undercutting their legitimacy, as well as the U.S. claims that China is undermining the so-called U.S.-led rules-based international order. Elsewhere, the two sides have also come into friction concerning China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, with the U.S. carrying out regular freedom of navigation operations in the area. The United States now also sends warships and military aircraft through the Taiwan Strait on a monthly basis, something innovated under President Donald Trump, so as to deter China's historical claims on the island. In turn, Washington has urged its allies, Australia, Canada, France, and the United Kingdom, to act similarly, which has raised concerns in China of the country being strategically constrained by the illegal U.S. interference in the region. We now present you an article written by Chris Ogden, Senior Lecturer and Associate Professor in Asian Security at the School of International Relations at University of St. Andrews in Scotland, under the heading Implications of U.S. Election on U.S.-China Relations. Please stay with us to hear more of Chris Ogden's article. The last 4 years have been one of the most tumultuous periods in modern China-U.S. relations. U.S. President Donald Trump has been the critical catalyst of this upheaval, as he has oscillated between presenting China as a valued partner in international affairs to its being a pariah state that needs to be ever more constrained. Such fluctuations have mounted in intensity as the Trump presidency has progressed. They have left observers uncertain as to whether or not this is a purposeful strategy of the leader of the purported world's most powerful country, or an indication of an untethered, badly conceived, and even short-sighted policy. Such a wild approach has been no clearer than in their economic relationship. Here, the United States has strived to rebalance its trade relations with China, in particular to reduce Beijing's long-standing trade surplus with Washington. The trade surplus has been argued by U.S. elites to have led to an unequal relationship, with a rising China exploiting and challenging America's economic supremacy. This divide has increasingly taken on a symbolic quality, with it becoming representative of a rising China that is soon to surmount the U.S. in global affairs, and which U.S. elites now regard as the most pressing strategic threat to its global position. In an attempt to pressure China, the U.S. president initiated a trade war in 2018 and ratcheted up tariffs on Chinese imports to the American market. By early 2020, these amounted to over $400 billion in tariffs, with China imposing its own retaliatory tariffs of $138 billion on its U.S. imports. Such steps have taken place amidst ongoing trade talks between the two sides and have been viewed as a negotiating tactic that has ultimately been detrimental to both countries' economies. In late 2020, the World Trade Organization WTO said U.S. tariffs violated international trade rules, undercutting their legitimacy, as well as the U.S. claims that China is undermining the so-called U.S.-led rules-based international order. Elsewhere, the two sides have also come into friction concerning China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, with the U.S. carrying out regular freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea area. The U.S. now also sends warships and military aircraft through the Taiwan Strait on a monthly basis, something innovated under President Trump, so as to deter China's historical claims on the island. In turn, Washington has urged its allies, Australia, Canada, France, and the United Kingdom, to act similarly, which has raised concerns in China of the country being strategically constrained by the illegal U.S. interference in the region. Such a constraint could prevent Beijing from pursuing its foreign policy goals in the region. Those foreign policy goals were mutual economic and political cooperation and relations with East and West Asian countries. Concerning the coronavirus pandemic, narratives emanating from the United States along with its Western allies have targeted China as being culpable for the outbreak. In a recent speech at the United Nations, President Donald Trump openly claimed that China had knowingly unleashed the COVID-19 plague on the world, which prompted a terse response from Beijing's officials that it is a cooperative, not a confrontational country, that firmly has no intention to fight either a Cold War or a hot one with any country. All of these aspects of U.S.-China relations will present particular challenges regardless of the outcome of the U.S. election, in particular concerning growing U.S. concerns over China's international goals. In this regard, Beijing will certainly need to redouble its diplomatic efforts to present the country as a responsible and benign international actor, through which others can benefit, in primarily economic terms. That, by most accounts, China has the coronavirus largely under control, means that it has been able to restart its economic activity, which gives Beijing the ability to kickstart and lead an international recovery. That most Western countries are still overwhelmed by the pandemic reinforces this capability and gives China the further chance to gain greater international cooperation. It also appears that it is now the United States that faces the greatest challenge to its international legitimacy, the consequences of which may have profound implications for its own global standing. This relates to the U.S. President's handling of the pandemic. That the U.S. President, Donald Trump himself, has now become infected points to a leader but also a wider political system around him, including senior military leaders, senators, and most of his election campaign staff that had a nonchalant, under-prepared and irresponsible attitude to the major global health challenge of our times. President Donald Trump's infection also marks a major national security threat for the U.S. and the world. Given his age, obesity, and unhealthy diet, it is feasible that the leader of a country which claims that it is the world's most powerful one may become incapacitated from leading the U.S. in the next few weeks. Crucially here, it has been widely reported that Trump will be unwilling to accept any negative outcome in the forthcoming election. Apart from suggesting that he would not leave office, he may try to rally supporters, potentially even violently, to protect his position. Crucially here, some of the medication he's taking to help him recover from COVID-19 has the potential to debilitate his mental capacities and overall judgment. This could impact his ability to recognize when he is incapable of leadership, but also spark irrational tweets and behavior that may destabilize the United States and even the world. If the U.S. president were to die, either during or in the months after the election, in all likelihood the country will be thrown into a truly unprecedented constitutional crisis. Such crises will only be to Beijing's advantage among other U.S. competitors, especially given that China is in many ways returning, if not returned to, its pre-coronavirus economic activity. If U.S.-China relations do signify a contest for supremacy between the world's two foremost countries, Washington's handling of the coronavirus pandemic and its impact on the U.S. presidential election could very well indicate the U.S.'s decline on the international stage and essentially speed up China's path to global cooperation and mutual relations.
The Debate.
A senior Iranian defense official is assassinated near the capital, Tehran, in a terrorist attack. In a statement, the defense ministry said the vehicle of the head of the Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, Mr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was targeted by terrorists. The Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the act of cowardice shows the desperate warmongering of its perpetrators, adding that there are serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. Zarif also urged the international community, especially the EU, to end, quote, their shameful double standards, and condemns the Iranian defense official's assassination. Between 2010 and 2012, four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated. Tehran and Western intelligence agencies have long put the blame on Israel, an accusation that was never rejected by officials of the Israeli regime. Its debate will be looking further into that issue. We're now joined by journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who's joining us from Brussels, also with us on its debate. We have author and political analyst Mr. Saad Shath joining us from Belfast. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Brussels. What was your initial reaction when you heard the news? And who do you believe to be behind such acts against Iran?
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu said he has reached several achievements this week. He can't share all the details with us. That is typical of this particular Israeli Prime Minister, to show off and disregard the deniability previously adopted by Israeli MPs for many years when they carry out target killing or assassination abroad. Netanyahu also, he is under domestic scrutiny with a very strong possibility to face the Court of Justice. He's accused not only of corruption but also bribery, particularly related to the submarine and missile purchase that is around $2 billion, and this is where the Israeli Minister of Defense, Benny Gantz, accused him in form a committee. So he has all the interest to escape toward a possible war or a battle or any act similar to the one he has committed today. And also Israel is aware that Iran is not in a position to retaliate with a full all-out war when the attack is not that big to deserve to put the whole Middle East into a stage of war. That particularly when the assassination of the Iranian professor today won't change much in Iran nuclear or ballistic missile program. This is why Israel may find the audacity not only to carry out the target assassination, but also to hit more targets in Iran in the future or carry out more assassination, knowingly that Tehran is aware that President Trump is eager to do something before he leaves office on the 20th of January 2021. So yes, Israel is trying to drag Iran and the Middle East into direct confrontation, and we know that the Americans leaked the information of the arrival of the U.S. B-52 toward the Middle East and the U.S. fleet in the Mediterranean that is ready. And there is a general support from many Gulf countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, that are ready to support and finance Israel, particularly with the latest normalization with Israel. So we do not exclude that the meeting between Netanyahu and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia, on the Red Sea, beginning of this week, was not a normalization of the relationship that already exists since many years, but it has not been announced, but it was under the table coordination and informative military hit against Iran.
Saad Shath, your thoughts on the issue. What are the motives behind carrying out such acts of terrorism?
From the day one that the West planted the Zionist entity in the heart of historical Palestine, and the Zionist entity carries out targeted killings and assassination mainly against Arab and Muslim scientists. We witnessed that in Egypt in the 50s, 60s, 70s, The same thing goes in Syria and Iraq. Iran from the 1979 onwards. They want to make sure these countries will stay undeveloped, underdeveloped, and they are backwards, and they cannot industrialize themselves, and they cannot catch up with the Western progress, and they cannot even be sufficient in fulfilling the needs of their own population or the needs of defending their country. So because they are in the heart of the world in the Middle East, their wealth and their geopolitical areas is controlled by the Zionist entity in the West. This is the target, and Israel to stay supreme. We witnessed from 1979 the Iranian elites and scientists being targeted from after the break of the revolution. Since Shah al-Iran was a Western puppet, they needed him and they didn't target him. But since the Iranian become sovereign over their decision after the Islamic revolution in Iran, and Iran becomes targeted, becomes sanctioned, and becomes besieged to destabilize the revolution and to loot after that the world. This is the target. Your guest touched on issues which I want to expand a little bit on here. There was a meeting between the Zionists and the Saudis and the Americans in Saudi Arabia just shortly. And we want to see these three developments which indicates to more actions against Iran. The first one was by the Zionist media itself, a Walla newspaper which is close to the intelligence apparatus in there. It's confirmed there was instructions issued to the army leadership to be prepared and on standby in anticipation of any development or offensive to be launched against Iran. This is a few days ago. The second one, the U.S. military command, as your guest said, dispatched the B-52 bomber equipped with a giant bombs that can penetrate bunkers to destroy nuclear facilities within deep in the mountains, like they say, fruits in Iran. The third point, which is their meeting in Rome and the Red Sea between Pompeo and bin Salman and the Zionist the Prime Minister Netanyahu, when they wanted to tackle to tackle the issue of Iran, they wanted to make sure there is an action planned against Iran and going to be taken in place, and they want to abort any attempts by President-elect Joe Biden to rejoin the Iran nuclear agreements. The last point I want to make in here, the fingerprint of the attack on Mohsen Fakhreddin was the professor shows the advanced, capable, sophisticated intelligence agency who can trigger an explosion and then target the man with fire to make sure he will be gunned down, die by the explosion or gunned down. This is a sophisticated operation. It shows all the fingerprints and the signs of the Zionist entity or sophisticated intelligence agency.
Mr. Magni, having in mind the Israeli threats in the past, what's also alarming here in this situation is that just recently Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was mentioned in a video report by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It's not too difficult to connect the dots here, is it?
Absolutely. It is quite obvious, particularly when we see also President Trump retweeting a former Mossad officer who spoke about the assassination of Professor Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and confirming that he was on the Mossad target list since quite some time. And as your guest rightly said, the professor was responsible for the development of nuclear and ballistic missiles. The team that attacked was highly professional, planned. They put a car bomb to stop the driver, and that exploded a few meters ahead. And then a team of attackers decided to attack because they are trained to carry out such an assassination against a target, and it is highly possible the coordination with foreign intelligence services to rehearse this attack. So, however, the removal of one person never stopped a country from carrying out its objective. On the contrary, the assassination of a nuclear scientist and the four nuclear scientists before only give more incentive for Iran to motivate it and increase its nuclear enrichment program and develop missiles that reach a distance beyond the 2,000 kilometers. And we also have to bear in mind that President Trump has a personal vendetta against Iran. Trump tried to contact Iran 8 times and failed. He was waiting by the phone and the Iranians never called him up. He advised Iran to make a deal weeks before the election to add it to his achievement and increase his chances to win a second term. But because he didn't win, Trump would like to make sure, as your guest said, Trump wants the president-elect Joe Biden to be unable to abide by the nuclear deal signed by President Obama in 2015, and that he shredded, and want to put obstacles in front of any attempt by Biden administration to return to the deal. By pushing Iran to retaliate and leave office in the midst of a possible war in case Iran hit back Israel or hit U.S. bases in the Middle East, Trump and Israel and Saudi Arabia want to guarantee the no return to the nuclear deal. They want to eliminate the Iran voice for the right of the Palestinians, for the right of the axis of the resistance to exist, for the right of people to live without the U.S. dominance, imperialism in the region. However, it's very difficult to drag Iran into a war face to face unless there is real bombing of its nuclear sites by foreign force. Iran is expected to exert control and avoid being dragged to a battlefield where the timing and the terms are dictated by the enemies. So we have to wait and see. I don't think Iran would be just impulsive reactive in this case.
Safshath, Commander Hossein Dehan, a military advisor to Iranian leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is accused Israel of killing the Iranian nuclear scientist to try to provoke a war. He said, quote, in the last days of the political life of their ally Donald Trump, the Zionists seek to intensify pressure on Iran to create a full-blown war. Do you see a relation there, Trump, Netanyahu, and the terrorist attack in Iran earlier today?
Yes, I see the relation very clearly myself, especially the professor was a prominent scientist who was a leader in his research and innovation of defense industry for Iran. And we seen how Iran reacted to the assassination of the late General Lieutenant General Soleimani when they attacked Ain al-Assad and other American bases in Iraq, and the Americans couldn't retaliate. And later on, we discovered from American media and American even members of the Democratic Party said that most of the soldiers, which they said they weren't injuries, all of them have head injuries, and most of them, you know, like damaged, totally damaged, head damaged. And the other point in here, the Americans will want Israel to attack. They want the Saudis to be involved in like an attrition war against Iran. The Americans, from the lesson which they've been learned from the attack of Ain al-Assad, they didn't mobilize that great force to attack Iran. They just want to pressurize Iran, and they want to show America is still in a fighting mood, but they cannot do it. We witnessed one rocket, the Houthis movement, launched a couple of days ago, which is flies low, and no radars, no sophisticated weaponry the Americans have in Saudi Arabia even spotted that one rocket which destroyed the Aramco's station fired by the Houthis, which puts two. This is compared to the Iranian sophisticated weaponry is nothing. So they knew what they are facing. They cannot launch a war in Iran, but they are playing dirty, dirty games in there. They just want to stabilize the region. They want to make sure things are very bad to the president-elect Biden, and he cannot rejoin the Iranian nuclear deal because they want to create a further animosity with the Democrats now, so they cannot sit with the Iranian and reschedule the American rejoining of the nuclear deal. This is what the Americans and the Israelis do, and the Saudis desperate to do that because they know the next administration will be targeting their human rights record, their involvement in the war in Yemen, and a lot of other things.
Elijah Magnier, the U.S., the Saudis, the Israelis, they've been very open and vocal about not wanting Iran's nuclear energy program to excel. Why do you think they are threatened by Iran's progress?
Because since 1979, President Carter imposed sanctions on Iran because Iran refused to submit, because Iran is not accepting the U.S. dominance over the Middle East and over Iran itself, because Iran has allies in the region that think in the same way. Iran support the Palestinian cause, support the freedom of the Lebanese, support non-regime change in Syria, support the unity of Iraq, while Biden and President Trump wanted to divide the country. I don't think there is a difference between Trump and Biden, at the exception of Biden is a more expert and more diplomat than Trump, but both are considering Iran as an enemy. Hillary Clinton said it clearly, and they consider Iran as an enemy because Iran is causing trouble to Israel. Iran is supporting the Palestinians in their cause. If the Palestinians want the right to return to their land, they want their territory back. They don't want to be under the dominance of the Israelis. They want their claim that they have been taken since 1947, and they don't want the Americans to dominate an area that is 10,000 kilometers away from the United States of America. This is why Iran is an enemy. And Iran is an enemy because in Iran there are democratic elections in the country, while in any other Arab state, and particularly Gulf country, it is ruled by a monarchy, there are no democratic elections. But that is secondary. The main problem of Iran is support to the Palestinian state. If Iran stops support to Palestine, then all the problems with Iran will be solved. However, Iran has written in its constitution the support of all oppressed people in the world, above all the Palestinian cause. It cannot violate its AIM commitment, the commitment that has been taken upon itself to support the right cause of all the population. And that is the main problem of Iran, and this is why they want Iran a shark without teeth.
So, Afshath, let's talk about another matter that has been brought up a lot today, and that's the issue of the lack of condemnation. Iran's foreign minister, Zarif, he urged the international community, especially the EU, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the Iranian defense officials' assassination. Why is there such hypocrisy in this case? And are you surprised by the lack of condemnation and lack of outrage?
No, I'm not surprised. And I think some of the Western intelligence agencies were helping the Mossad at some stages in achieving such targeted killings. Since Iran today is inherited the position which Nasser of Egypt, the revolutionary leader of Egypt in the 60s, found himself in, anti-imperialist, leading the region anti-imperialist campaign. So today, the Iranian revolution is carrying on the same agenda which is Egypt, revolutionary Egypt in the 60s used to do, leading figure in third world countries against imperialism and against the oppressor and supporting the oppressed people. This is what Iran's today, as your guest said himself, I agree 100%. And when Iran finds itself behind the Palestinian and supporting the Palestinian, this is for the Zionist entity is disturbing. Since they launched their wars from 1948 till the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and follows against anybody supporting the Palestinians or the Palestinian movement. The Arab Springs, or what they call it Arab Springs, was targeted against countries which supported Palestine. Rightly, Iran today finds itself behind the Palestinian cause, behind Hezbollah, and the leading figure and the leading country, actually, of the resistance camp, which is stand against the imperialism and its function state, the Zionist entity, Israel. And all the Arab reactionary regimes, which are the satellites of the Zionist entity and the Americans' imperialism. So this is why Iran is second, and this is why you see the Western countries who implanted the Zionist entity in there to weaken the region and to help the West in controlling these ex-colonies and suck their wealth and make sure they are open market to its own goods. They want that this situation to continue, these countries to be weaker. When they assassinate Iranian scientists, it means to them that will put Iran back in a backward position.
One last question for both of our guests. Elijah Magnier, what should Iran's response be? Different viewpoints suggest these terrorist acts will only make Iran more adamant in confronting its antagonists.
I think Iran should continue in its nuclear program, should continue its entrenchment and to raise the percentage and to go toward full nuclear cycle without the necessity to make a bomb, but that will make Iran stronger. I think Iran should continue with its missile program to go beyond the 2,000 and reach the 5,000 kilometers. And I think Iran should not retaliate now and give Trump the possibility to have his little war in the last few weeks in power.
Okay, Saab Shath, same question for you. What should Iran's response be?
Iran's retaliation should be in industrializing more, in educating more, in furthering the industries, in making the life of their own people more secure, and in furthering the security and defense industry. This way, Iran will win. And that's where we see the Americans couldn't revenge against the attacks of the Iranian missiles in Iran.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's debate. Allow me to thank my guests, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels.